into this kind of chaotic strategy that's underway by President Trump of using litigation delay the inevitable, to suggest that the outcome is not right or fair is deeply, deeply troubling. At the end of the day, we are weighing in on some of these cases where we deem appropriate. When we look at the pattern, the kind of cherry-picked pattern where these suits are being filed, we're finding that these suits are being filed in places that are home to large numbers of voters of color. And so we are weighing in on these cases when appropriate, but we expect that they will all fail at the end of the day, and that what we would have lost is time for a smooth transition.
We have to leave it there. Thank you for being with us, President Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Be safe, save lives, wear a mask.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share. So send a smile and show you care.
Driving around and we would see Nazi skinheads, we'd jump out of the car and we're like, are you white pride, and we start swinging.
They are part and parcel of the story of Oregon. They are part of the history here. And so we should never behave as if because they become less visible, they've gone away. In fact, they've always been here.
Late one night in 1988, Mulugeta Sarah was beaten with a baseball bat and left for dead.
Three white kids who killed Sarah weren't outside agitators, but members of East Side White Pride, a neo-Nazi street gang.
By the mid-90s, racist skinheads had disappeared from the streets of Portland. How did this happen?
It Did Happen Here is a documentary podcast that chronicles how immigrants, civil rights activists, and militant youth worked together with a diversity of tactics to drive white supremacist street gangs out of Portland.
The first episode will be released November 13th, the 32nd anniversary of the murder of Mulugeta Sarah.
Stay tuned.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's election director was abruptly fired by text message late last week. The head of the DOJ's Election Crimes Unit has resigned in protest. And COVID-19 continues to spread across the country, with Oregon surpassing 50,000 total cases. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 10th, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon's election director was abruptly fired over text message by the Secretary of State after pointing out serious issues with the state's aging and vulnerable election technology. Elections Director Stephen Trout learned in a text message Thursday night that he had been fired. On Friday, Republican Secretary of State Bev Clarno announced to county clerks and other election officials that it was Trout's last day with the agency. Elections officials speculated that the decision was due in part to recent complaints made by Trout about the state's aging election technology. In a November 2nd letter, Trout described problems with the internet technology side of the Secretary of State's office and indicated he would be looking for another job. Klarno's spokesperson, Andrea Chiappella, asserted the decision was not related to his criticisms, saying that he planned to leave on December 15th anyway. Chiappella added, quote, "It was solely because Secretary Klarno wanted a smooth transition with stable leadership in elections through certification, the Electoral College, and the end of the year." In the November 2nd letter, Trout also said $5.7 million in federal virus relief allocations must be returned by the end of the year because the legislature did not authorize it to be spent. Among the complaints raised by Trout are that the system the election technology operates on is Microsoft Windows Server 2008, which, more than a decade after its release, Microsoft no longer supports. There is also no multi-factor identification to protect the system from hackers. The Secretary of State's office was going to take bids in October for a new voter registration system, but Klarno paused it without consulting with county clerks or Trout. Klarno's office denied any wrongdoing, saying that the project management team raised numerous red flags that required the agency to slow down to ensure a successful procurement process and outcome. Klarno will be replaced in January by Democratic State Senator Shamia Fagan, who won the election for Secretary of State against Republican State Senator Kim Thatcher. Yesterday, the state allocated funds to help fight the homeless crisis in Oregon. KBOO's Al Kahn has the story.
The Salem Statesman Journal reported that yesterday, Oregon lawmakers approved spending $35 million to aid in the ongoing homeless crisis. The Joint Emergency Board, which denied the proposal 2 weeks ago, will use the allocated money to buy as many as 20 hotels and motels and retrofit them into homeless shelters. The project turnkey and based on a program in use in California, the proposal responds to the impact the coronavirus and economic recession has had on the state's homeless community and will likely provide 1,000 housing units during the upcoming winter months when falling temperatures critically threaten homeless people. The funds are to be funneled through the Oregon Community Foundation, which will establish grants available statewide and open to tribal communities, housing authorities, nonprofit groups, and local city and county governments. Any unspent funds will be returned to the state by June 30th of next year. The proposed funds will not be used for those people impacted by this summer's wildfires, as the emergency board had already allocated $30 million to those communities on October 23rd. Some lawmakers have expressed that if turnkey is deemed to be a success, that the model could be used again in the future. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
On Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 771 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 51,909. Oregon health officials also reported 3 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 737. Starting tomorrow, Wednesday, 9 counties will begin a 2-week pause on social activities to help stop the spread of coronavirus in the state. The counties are Baker, Clackamas, Jackson, Malheur, Multnomah, Umatilla, Union, and Washington. The pause will be in effect from November 11th through the 25th. The measures within the pause include urging all businesses to mandate working from home, pausing visits to long-term care facilities, reducing maximum restaurant and indoor activity capacity to 50 people, and limiting social gatherings to your household or no more than 6 people if the gathering includes those from outside your household. The state has seen a string of record-setting days of coronavirus cases in the past week. On Sunday, the state surpassed 50,000 COVID cases. In a Tuesday press conference, Governor Kate Brown said Oregon is on the wrong road, adding, quote, "Our fears that the virus would spread out of control when the colder months set in is certainly becoming a reality." Brown said that hospital capacity is becoming a concern despite current availability. The Oregon Health Authority's chief medical officer, Dana Harganani, said there has been an 83% increase in hospitalized patients over the last 4 weeks in the state, with a 57% increase in the Portland metro area. Oregon has more than 100 ICU beds and 700 regular hospital beds currently available. Harganani said, quote, "There are limitations to what Oregon's healthcare system can handle. Even with regional planning and the hard work of all our hospital partners, We cannot handle ever-growing high daily case counts and widespread hospitalizations. The system is flexible and has capacity, but only to a point. Nationally, more than 10.2 million people have been infected with the novel coronavirus. At least 239,500 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 116,000 cases per day, an increase of 64% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 51.2 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.2 million people have died across the world. Some organizations are calling for greater transferability of college course credits between schools. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Citing a pair of problems, higher education groups want institutions to make it easier for students to transfer course credits between schools. Members of the Scaling Partners Network say COVID-19 and the economic downturn are likely to lead to more students switching schools, but they aren't always able to transfer all of their credits, leading to a loss of money and time. Dr. Anthony Carnevale is director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He says institutions largely function on their own rather than in collaboration.
We've never made higher education a system, and we've come to the point in our history where it needs to be, because the vast majority, or the majority, 2 out of 3 at least, Americans need higher education in order to get a good job.
Half of bachelor's degree graduates attend at least 2 schools before receiving their degrees, according to the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. In 2017, Oregon passed House Bill 2998, which led to the development of the Oregon Transfer Compass to streamline the transfer process. But how many credits can be transferred still depends on the institution. Universities often limit the percentage of credits that can be applied toward a degree if they weren't attained at that school. The Scaling Partners Network's call to action notes students of color are more likely to transfer, and so this issue disproportionately affects them. Along with making credits more portable, Carnevale says funding is necessary to address the racial gap in higher education.
Unless we fund public institutions, we're going to have a wider and wider divide between what are essentially affluent white Americans and minorities and low-income white Americans in our higher education system.
The letter also calls on policy leaders to make financial aid more portable. Carnevale says more data on this issue is necessary to understand it fully. The call to action includes groups advocating for racial justice in higher education, university associations, and policy organizations. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Advocates of the push for D.C. statehood say it became more urgent over the summer after federal forces were used to confront protests against racial injustice and police violence. Diane Bernard has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The 2020 election season saw 35 U.S. Senate races, but one jurisdiction still has no representation in Congress, the District of Columbia. More than 700,000 people live in Washington, D.C. That's more than Vermont or Wyoming. They pay federal taxes, but don't control their own budget or laws and have no voting member in Congress. Ty Hobson Powell is lead organizer for 51 for 51, a group advocating for D.C. to become the 51st state. He says although they fulfill obligations as everyday Americans, Congress makes all the laws and decisions for the majority black and brown residents of the nation's capital.
We pay the highest federal taxes. We send men and women to the services. We serve on juries. So from a racial equity standpoint, you're looking at enfranchising a population of people that has been left out of democracy for generations.
This summer, the House of Representatives voted to grant statehood to D.C., which leans heavily Democratic. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he won't bring it up for a vote in the Republican-dominated Senate since it could mean 2 more Democratic senators. Hobson Powell notes that D.C. statehood has become more urgent amid protests against police violence and President Donald Trump's decision to deploy federal law enforcement against protesters. If D.C. becomes a state, it would gain autonomy. It would also be able to impose sales, property, and income taxes on the federal government, which uses local services but doesn't pay local taxes. Hobson Powell Powell says that revenue would help support badly needed social services.
We would have a larger pool of money to draw from to allocate towards the things that we care about, things like affordable housing, things like gun violence prevention and interruption work. We would be able to pass laws that reflect the local values of Washingtonians and not be held hostage by Congress.
He stresses the importance of educating people about this lack of representation. Most folks don't realize, he says, that more than 500,000 Americans are legally barred from the democratic process because they live in D.C. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1989, celebrating Germans begin to tear down the Berlin Wall after East German officials allowed travel from East to West Berlin. One of the most infamous symbols of the Cold War was reduced to rubble over the next few weeks as euphoric people and souvenir hunters chipped away parts of the wall. The quote of the day is from former President John F. Kennedy, who said, quote, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable." The head of the U.S. Justice Department's Elections Crimes Unit has resigned in protest. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
Richard Pilger, the head of the Justice Department's Elections Crimes Branch, has resigned in protest over Attorney General William Barr's recent memo giving authorization to investigate alleged voter fraud by federal prosecutors. Pilger stated that Barr's authorization of such investigations goes against the Justice Department's 40-year-old non-interference policy to wait until elections have been finalized before launching any probes into allegations of impropriety. Barr's memo told prosecutors that they could begin investigative actions, such as interviewing witnesses immediately, at a time when normally they would need permission from the Election Crimes Section. The move by Barr seems to be an attempt to support Trump's attack on the integrity of the election. It is not clear as to what impact such probes could have on an election in which President-elect Biden leads Trump by an abundance of votes into tens of thousands in several key states. Trump's lawyers have already filed lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, and Michigan, most of which have been thrown out due to a lack of any substantial evidence of fraud. The Attorney General's authorization of investigations seems to be an attempt to find any such evidence which could be used to overturn election results in key states. Barr has steadfastly stood by Trump in his baseless allegations of election improprieties, which Trump claims are the reason he lost so many states to Biden in the general election. Pilger will remain in the Justice Department as a prosecutor in the Public Corruption Investigations Unit. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
The General Services Administration is being urged to cooperate with a peaceful transition of presidential power. Diane Bernard has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As President Donald Trump continues to fight election results with legal challenges, concerns are rising that his administration isn't fully cooperating with President-elect Joe Biden's team for a peaceful transition of power. The head of the General Services Administration, which manages the finances and administration of the handover, has not formally recognized Biden as the winner. Kate Shaw is a law professor at Cardozo School of Law. She says according to the Presidential Transition Act, this needs to happen before federal funds are released to run a successful transition.
This does, I think, very much hinder the ability of the incoming, you know, President-elect Biden and the transition team to fully get up to speed on the range of hugely pressing issues that they will be in a position to actually manage and implement starting January 20th.
She says the GSA chief might be waiting for the results of Trump's legal challenges, but she thinks the lawsuits are based on inaccurate claims and urges the GSA to recognize Biden Biden and move the transition forward. Trump still has not formally acknowledged Biden's win and has not conceded the election. Vanita Gupta with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights acknowledges that many Americans are worried about what will happen if Trump doesn't concede, but she says to remain calm. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires the losing presidential candidate to make a concession.
The losing candidate doesn't get to decide whether he or she is removed from office. The voters decided that. And we have a President-elect Biden, Vice-President-elect Kamala Harris that will be installed in the White House on January 20th, 2021, regardless of how the losing candidate feels.
For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
Incumbents facing runoffs in January in Georgia call for the Secretary of State's resignation as the Biden team works on the transition and Trump campaign lawsuits continue. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
As we see people who are genuinely upset with the outcomes, people who are genuinely thrilled with the outcomes, the facts are the facts, regardless of outcomes. And that's one of the things we're focusing on here is getting our count accurate and right, giving accurate information.
That's Gabriel Sterling, spokesperson for Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican facing calls to resign from his state's two Republican incumbent senators with runoffs in January. With stiff competition from their Democratic opponents, Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler claim without evidence that the secretary is responsible for unspecified, quote, failures. Raffensperger says he won't resign, noting the election followed the law and went very well. Hundreds of thousands more people voted than in 2016 there, despite the pandemic. Here's Sterling again.
This election on Election Day was an amazing success.
Georgia's January runoffs will decide which party controls the Senate and whether the new Biden administration can expect to move legislation through Congress. While the Trump campaign challenges votes in states with close margins, Maine Senator Susan Collins congratulated Biden and Harris. Most Republican senators are still silent or sticking with the president. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell doubled down yesterday.
President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
The Trump administration is putting other roadblocks in front of a transition. To proceed normally, the General Services Administration must approve certain kinds of access and funds, and the Trump appointee leading the GSA has signaled no immediate plans to do so. Kate Shaw teaches at Cardozo School of Law in New York.
That is typically not a controversial determination. The one time it was in the year 2000 when the GSA administrator did not make the formal determination that George W. Bush had won that election until December 13th.
Post-election, as expected, there's been a shakeup in administration staff. Yesterday, Trump announced he'd fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Norman Ornstein is with the American Enterprise Institute.
He's already fired a number of people who he saw as insufficiently loyal to him.
The Biden team is moving forward with more than 2 months before they can take action. The president-elect wants the public to do their part to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Do it for yourself. Do it for your neighbor. A mask is not a political statement.
Dr. David Holtgrave, dean of the School of Public Health at SUNY Albany, says the leadership is critical.
Given the number of cases that we've seen per day, the hospitalization, the number of deaths still seeming to be roughly 1,000 a day, some days even more than that, it just really can't continue on. And I think waiting until Inauguration Day is not an option.
And today, the U.S. Supreme Court considers another key case, whether to repeal the Affordable Care Act. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
A court hears arguments on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Oglala Lakota voters elect a new tribal president. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The D.C. Court of Appeals heard arguments last week to help determine the fate of the Dakota Access Pipeline. A Department of Justice lawyer argued against requiring the Army Corps of Engineers to complete an environmental study, even though the Corps has already started one. A lawyer for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says the pipeline no longer has a valid easement and should be shut down now. Victoria Wicks has more.
A D.C. Circuit judge ordered this summer that the Corps of Engineers did not comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, when it granted an easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Judge James Boasberg vacated the easement that allowed DAPL to cross under the Owyhee Reservoir. He also ordered that the pipeline should be shut down by August 5th. The pipeline company and the Corps quickly appealed, and the D.C. Court of Appeals lifted the shutdown order. However, the appeals court left in place the decision vacating the easement. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is represented by Jan Hasselman from Earth Justice. Judges tell Hasselman they can't grant the tribe's renewed request to shut down the pipeline. They say they lifted the injunction in August because the circuit court had failed to make the necessary findings to support it, and those findings still don't exist. But Hasselman says an injunction is not necessary for a shutdown because the appeals court left in place the vacating of the Corps of Engineers easement.
The easement regulates the operation of the pipeline. They are regulating the operation of the pipeline underneath Lake Owyhee.
Hasselman says DAPL can't legally operate without an easement and should be shut down on that basis. The Corps of Engineers is represented by DOJ lawyer James Masonette. He says the Army Corps is now doing an environmental study that will take more than a year to complete, but he denies that that study is necessary. Masonette says the Corps had already meticulously addressed concerns of tribes before granting the easement. The appellate judges will take the case under advisement and issue a ruling later. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Oglala Lakota voters in South Dakota have elected a new tribal leader. President Julian Bearrunner lost re-election last week to Kevin Killer, a Native advocate and state lawmaker. Richard Tubles reports.
According to the unofficial vote tally from the Oglala Sioux Tribe's general election, Kevin Killer will become the next president of the tribe. Killer received 2,228 votes, edging out President Julian Bearrunner, who got 1,117. Killer says that as president, he hopes to rebuild the trust between the tribal government and the people.
You know, making sure that the office of the presidency is going to be in all these districts, understanding that, you know, we're going to try to meet people where they're at and begin to understand that, you know, we need, in order to make really monumental change, we got to have people's trust.
Alicia Musso won the tribe's vice presidency with 1,973 votes to beat out the tribe's former president, Brian Brewer, who got 1,512. I'm Richard Tubles in Rapid City.
Multiple agencies, including the Navajo Police Department, helped execute federal search warrants Monday near Shiprock, New Mexico. The FBI executed the warrants on the Navajo Nation in regards to an ongoing investigation involving hemp. In September, Navajo police began mobilizing an incident command and hemp farm hotline to address public concerns. Police have also been meeting with community members but could not provide additional information on the ongoing federal investigation. The Navajo Nation is cracking down on illegal hemp farming in the Shiprock area. Lawsuits have been filed against farmers alleging illegal hemp and/or marijuana productions. Language was also amended to the Navajo Criminal Code to clarify the legal definition of marijuana. The issue has caused disharmony in the area, including protests from community members concerned about safety and impacts on the environment. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Plans to mitigate the severity of future wildfires in eastern Oregon forests may put more carbon into the atmosphere. New research, published in Frontiers Journal for Forests and Global Change, indicates planned logging of larger trees east of the Cascades will greatly affect carbon storage management in public forests. As part of its wildfire management and restoration efforts this year, the U.S. Forest Service moved to amend a previous rule limiting the cutting of large trees in six national forests east of the Cascades. The rule is part of the Eastside Screens protections put in place 25 years ago to restore natural habitats and counter the overharvesting of old-growth trees. The Forest Service wants to amend a provision that protects trees 21 inches in diameter or larger. According to an August news release, the plan will, quote, make it easier to create landscapes that withstand and recover more quickly from wildfire, drought, and other disturbances. Too many large trees in densely packed areas pose a risk to the spread and intensity of forest fires. As climate change progresses, record wildfire seasons, such as those experienced by western states this summer, will become more frequent. While too many large trees are bad for fire spread, the harvesting of these trees risks releasing sequestered carbon from forests into the atmosphere. Large trees store far greater amounts of carbon than smaller trees. While large trees comprise only 3% of all trees in these federal forests, they hold 42% of all above-ground carbon storage. Cutting them down not only releases the carbon into the atmosphere, it also diminishes overall storage capacity for the entire forest. Officials hope to find balance between decreased forest density and increased carbon storage as they move forward. The Forest Service is currently reviewing public comments, along with environmental assessments on the matter. A decision on whether to amend protections for large trees is expected in the spring. Florida is hiring a mental health coordinator to help people recover from disasters, since extreme weather can leave lingering mental health consequences. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From broken buildings to uprooted trees, extreme weather can leave behind a lot of visible damage. But there is invisible damage, too. Many survivors face mental health struggles after a storm.
They've experienced traumatic loss, fear, displacement. It's very traumatizing, and that's an abnormal feeling. And people need reassurance that it's normal to feel that way, an abnormal event has occurred, and that there's resources and support there, and that they will be resilient, and they will get through this.
Darcy Abbott is a social worker. Last year, she became the mental health coordinator for disaster recovery at the Florida Division of Emergency Management. After an event such as a hurricane, her job is to work with state agencies, relief organizations, and private counselors to coordinate services.
So that we can best respond to what is needed during the recovery process.
Abbott says that her position is unique. Other states have mental health coordinators, but Florida is the first to connect the role with emergency management. And in a state vulnerable to hurricanes and rising seas, the role will be crucial as the climate changes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 10th, 2020. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Samantha Lau. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Diane Bernard, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Co-host Jacqueline Keeler joins Paul Rowland for a Native Election Roundup. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Dirt Bag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about persimmon taste trials and reveal a new plant of the month. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Thank you. thanks to the movie Jaws and the Discovery Channel's Shark Week, sharks sadly have a very scary but undeserved reputation with humans. What you might not be aware of, however, is that ingredients from sharks are part of many products that we humans use, including vaccines. With all the focus on finding a vaccination for COVID-19, scientists and conservationists are now concerned about the potential need to kill hundreds of thousands of sharks to produce a vaccine against COVID-19. Stephanie Brendel is the founder and executive director of Shark Allies in California, and I spoke with her recently about the effort to create awareness and convince pharmaceutical companies to consider alternatives. Stephanie, can you tell us how and why shark ingredients are used in vaccines and other products?
Yes, a shark oil is turned into shark squalene, and squalene is used in cosmetics and also as an adjuvant in vaccines. It has been used in flu vaccines before. It's not in every vaccine, but an adjuvant basically is used in some vaccines that it serves as a booster. It stimulates the immune system, and it also allows for less of the antigen to be used. So essentially, all the antigen will go a lot further and can make more vaccines. So adjuvants are a great thing. The problem is when an adjuvant that is potentially needs to be used for a global supply is based on a wild animal population, then that is potentially, well, it's unsustainable over the long range. It may not be immediately, you know, a problem. And nobody's going out and instantly killing 500,000 sharks. That's a little bit of a misunderstanding from headlines. We understand that nobody is out there to hunt them down right now. But the problem is that the vaccine market is so, it's not very transparent where and when sharks are used and how many will be in production. If it's not very likely that, that you know, all the vaccines for COVID will have shark adjuvants in them. But the problem is that we have coronaviruses for many more years to come, and each time there's a new vaccine developed, and maybe it will have to be given seasonally, it just continues and multiplies the problem, basically.
So are there non-animal alternatives to shark squalene that can be used, and are they just as effective?
Yes, from all the research and from all the communications that we've had with scientists and chemists and even vaccine and squalene producers. First of all, yes, squalene can be made from many sources, many plant sources, algae, yeast, bacteria, sugarcane, amaranth, olives, that all those plants can make high quality squalene. The way squalene becomes vaccine grade is really lies in the purification process. And that is similarly difficult or easy, whether you take it from a plant or from an animal. But essentially, by the time oil gets turned into squalene, the compounds and the parts of that is exactly the same, whether you use a plant or an animal. And obviously for cosmetics industry, they've already been switching over to plant-based squalene in many cases because it is, people are more conscientious about it. And it is as effective. And from just the most recent conversations I've had with alternative vaccine producers in the biotech area, they say that the vaccine that the squalene that they can produce, they can do a billion doses a month, and it is fully controlled, synthesized sugarcane squalene that can be reproduced at the same level over and over again. It's scalable, and apparently it can directly replace shark squalene in adjuvants and not just in cosmetics. So the alternatives are available. It's the willingness to switch over and let go of what has been done. Change is always hard. There's always cost involved. We don't say that it isn't, but the excuse that it is cheaper and easier to do is really not usually how conscientious.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah. Well, you know, why is it that the pharmaceutical companies won't consider using these alternatives first? It just seems like it would be the right thing to do.
I think it's just been available and hasn't been questioned. And I think that nobody has necessarily done it out of ill will. I don't think anyone is going out and going, I'm going to kill some sharks to make my potions. You know, I think it's just been available. maybe the awareness that what impact it has. Part of it is not being aware, doing business as usual, not seeing the reason why one should switch, and also the perception that shark oil and squalene is easy and cheap to come by, and they're being told that it's sustainable, it's just a byproduct, don't worry about it, those sharks would die anyway.
So they're being told that by the fishing industry?
I mean, that's generally what happens with all shark products. You know, don't worry about the fins, we're catching them for meat anyway. And then the meat guys say, well, you know, we're catching meat sharks, but if we don't sell the fins, it's not worth it. And then the cosmetics industry will say, oh, don't look at us because the fin guys are much worse. The vaccine guys say, oh, don't look at us because the cosmetics guys are much worse. The fact right. remains that the target list of sharks for shark liver oil is pretty extensive, and a lot of those sharks are endangered species or on CITES listings, and only a few of them are meat sharks. So what are those sharks being taken for in the first place? Well, maybe they are being taken for fins, and then the byproduct are livers, but that's a problem in itself. You know, right. one bad product justifying another product doesn't make it a good product. Two wrongs don't make a right. That is the problem. Each product that you take from the animal encourages this overfishing of sharks, and the of 100 plus million sharks being taken globally every year. So everybody likes to point at someone else, but I think each industry has to own their own responsibility, especially when there are alternatives. We're not losing human lives. We're not holding up a vaccine. Nothing bad happens to humans if we replace this adjuvant with plant-derived. There are solutions, and that's what we're getting at.
Well, you touched on this a little bit about the shark finning industry for shark fin soup. A lot of people are aware of that, and their fins are just cut off sometimes, and the sharks are thrown back into the ocean to die. Maybe they are used for meat. But the extraction and harvesting of sharks for vaccines can also be like equally as cruel for expediency, right? Can you explain how this happens sometimes?
In some cases, we've become aware of this practice of livering where sharks that are pulled up they could technically just let them go because they're not good for meat or for fins, but they are being, you know, their livers are taken. And of course, when you cut a shark open and take their liver, they die. Especially in the commercial fishing industry, things happen very quickly. They don't take great pains to make sure the animal has a peaceful
humane death. Yeah.
It's pretty quick slice and dice and throw the rest away. But, you know, whether it is a byproduct or whether it is targeted, the fact that, some of the rarest deep water species of sharks that are really not edible, but they have extremely large livers, if they're not already being targeted, they could surely be targeted, because when you have an animal that has 20 to 30% of their body weight is liver, and that mm-hmm. liver is filled with oil that you want, somebody that, you know, especially people that don't value sharks as anything important, and it's just some product that they want to get, it's a very easy incentive to get that animal that could normally be let go if it was bycatch, or that wouldn't even be targeted.
You know, I want to circle back to something you touched on a little bit ago to give people some perspective. You and other conservationists, activists, and scientists are involved in trying to stop this use. You're not in any way saying that the sharks are more important than creating a vaccine or than saving human lives. Can you explain a little bit your position on this?
Sure. I think the knee-jerk reaction immediately is when you say, please don't use this in such and such product, immediately people shut down and say, you're taking something away from us, or you're trying to put sharks in front of human health or human survival. In this case, that's not at all the case. And in the case of the vaccines, we didn't even start this until we knew that there are viable alternatives. So really what it means is that we can take care of humans and of sharks at the same time. Not a single person will have to go without a vaccine because we're working on this campaign. We've said from the beginning, if the first round of vaccines have to contain shark because this is where the testing is going, well, then so be it. it. But what we're saying is the sooner we are starting to look at alternatives, because then they have to be tested and then the industry has to accept them. And then, you know, agencies like the FDA have to approve things. There's still a long road to go. And the longer we wait, the more we rely on this resource that is very limited. And that limited resource will become more limited. And then it's also not really a secure supply. And it will get to the point where the price of that oil will go up because it becomes more rare. And then it also could limit how many doses you can make. What if the very best COVID vaccine turns out to be the one that is adjuvanted? Wouldn't it be great if we could mass produce it like crazy, consistently, from something that we don't have to take from a wild animal, that doesn't have to be overfished? Wouldn't that be a much better solution? Because in the end, that would be better for humans too, because we would know it is something we can reproduce over and over and over. When people talk about harvesting sharks, it's a really bad term, because we don't grow sharks, we just go out and get them. And harvest implies that it's something that you can just, that grows back, and it doesn't. So we can't farm them, we can't grow them. They don't grow back their liver, they don't grow back their fins. And the recovery and restoration of shark populations in the ocean is very slow. Once you take out a whole generation of breeding adults, it takes a long time for new adults to come along, because the way they grow and mature, more like mammals, you know, when you think of whales or humans, they have to be in their teenage years before they have young, and then they only have, you know, a litter every other year potentially. So this is not like tuna, who, you know, tuna reproduces within the first year and thousands of eggs. So if you leave tuna, and even they are endangered, but if you leave them alone for a couple of years, they can bounce back fairly quickly.
Right.
But sharks do not, because they evolve to be hunters, not to be hunted.
Sharks, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, they have a little bit of a PR problem. Can you explain why sharks are so essential to the ecosystem of the ocean, and how endangered are some of the species at this point?
Well, you know, our planet is covered by ocean 70%, and it's the engine of our planet. So what happens in the ocean is very important. To have biodiversity in the ocean is incredibly important, because, you know, we've done a pretty bad job at keeping that biodiversity on land, but then we invent things like, okay, farms, fences, you know, even robot technology. We kind of try to make up for our shortcomings on land. We're not going to be able to do that in the ocean. Sharks have evolved over millions of years to fill a very important part in most ecosystems at any depth and in any part of the ocean. And they're the regulators. If you can think of them as the white blood cells of the ocean, where they take out the diseased, the dead, the dying, they make sure that, you know, diseases won't spread to other populations. This affects everything from the very largest animals down to the coral reef, because it affects reef grazers, and which then affect algae growth and coral. So you take sharks out of the equation, it can have a cascading effect all the way down to maybe the crustaceans and the food fish that you want to catch. So you can absolutely not love sharks, but still see how important they are.
You know, you mentioned a little earlier that the headline of, you know, as many as 500,000 sharks could be killed for a COVID-19 vaccine is a little bit misleading. Can you give me a better interpretation of what could possibly happen with regard to this?
Yeah. So this number was sort of like giving the COVID vaccine a reference. Mm-hmm. But when people say that's too many, I'm like, well, we didn't even add up all the other use and the continued use, because we don't know that the first vaccine coming out is going to actually help everyone. Maybe only 50% of the people respond to it. We don't know if this is going to be a seasonal shot. Nobody says, people think they're going to get one vaccine for COVID and then we're done. It could be seasonal, like a flu vaccine. So are we going to get COVID vaccine shots like we do the flu every year? So the trajectory of this is pretty unpredictable. And it's, you know, a couple 100,000 sharks equivalent. We're not saying they're only taken for vaccine, but the equivalent of that could easily multiply into many more. We know that the trajectory is when more vaccine adjuvants that are made from sharks are being patented and used, then they will be promoted and then they will be used. which is just a limited, unsustainable practice that we should change sooner or later.
Right. Well, and it's good to get in front of it before the system already gets moving.
I mean, with endangered species, what is our track record? We are always complaining and doing nothing until they have to be on the list. So we're saying, why don't we get ahead of a problem for once? I mean, we're not even really truly ahead. We're just sort of potentially have a chance to redirect this. But why do we have to wait until we have definitive proof that, yes, this is going to be a bad thing?
If you'd like to learn more about the shark conservation effort and the use of shark products in COVID-19 vaccines and other products, you can go to sharkallies.com. For KBOO News, I'm Michelle Coppola.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today. So this is one of my favorite segments in which I get to review some of the interesting public health research that has come out in the past week. So let's go ahead and get started. Let's first start off with what I call some of the good reads. So these are some really interesting articles that came out. The first I like to talk about was published by NPR. It's called A New Hippocratic Oath Asks Doctors to Fight Racial Injustice and Misinformation. So this was a really great story where it looks as though you have a young group of physicians that are newly sworn in, and they're using a new oath now. It's a new Hippocratic Oath, and it's asking physicians to eliminate their personal biases, combat disinformation, and to improve health literacy, as well as be an ally to minorities and other underserved groups in society. I think this is great. I think every physician that are practicing right now should also stop what they're doing and also take this oath as well. And kudos to these young physicians that are coming up through the ranks. I have a lot of hope for them. Next is an article that was written by a colleague of mine. Her name is Dr. Rebecca Gee. She was the former health commissioner for the state of Louisiana. She's now the CEO of LSU Health Sciences. And this one is called Mask Mandates, a Public Health Framework for Enforcement. And what she's doing here, and this is published in Health Affairs, what she's doing here is setting up basically a framework to encourage mandates with respect to the wearing of masks. Because despite a growing number of mandatory mask requirements nationwide, enforcement strategies that have been used in other areas of public health, like with the wearing of seatbelts, for example, must also now be considered for masking as well, as we do know that masking is really the, and universal masking for that matter, is the most effective way, if not one of the most effective ways, for a decreasing likelihood of coronavirus transmission. The next one was an article in the Spanish newspaper El País. It wasn't an article as much as it was a group of illustrations, and there's two of them here. So one was in El País, the other one was in New York Times. So the first one that was in El País is called A Room, a Bar, and a Classroom, How the Coronavirus has Spread Through the Air. And what they do is they really, through beautiful illustrations, show how in a room, a bar, and a classroom, how coronavirus can be transmitted through those three environments. The risk of the contagion is highest in indoor spaces, as we know, but can be reduced by applying available measures to combat infection via aerosols. So again, this is an overview of the likelihood of infection in these three everyday scenarios. And it's based on safety measures as well as length of exposure. So really have a look at that. I thought it was great. And the New York Times version of this is mass work. Really, we'll show you how. Again, this is another beautiful illustration that shows the perspective of the virus from a droplet, an aerosolized particle, and then an aerosol, and how when it leaves your mouth, how it travels and it gets caught in the different fibers of the mask, and it shows you how successful masks are. So it was really, really interesting and really beautiful graphics. And then lastly, I just want to talk about another article that was also published by the New York Times. It was called A Rapid Virus Test Falters in People Without Symptoms. And I actually could not find the actual study, but what the New York Times reported was that at the University of Arizona, what they found was, and they used a rapid antigen-based test, that what they got was an 80% agreement with the PCR test, the one that's the swab that goes into your nose, and sometimes they have to go deep in the nasal pharynx to do the swab. So these antigen testing or these rapid testing were thought to be, obviously they're rapid, and they're found to also have pretty good agreement when people are sick, or they, in other words, they have symptoms of coronavirus. But what about people who don't feel sick but still have coronavirus? There was a 32% agreement with the PCRs. In other words, these rapid tests are just not effective, at least according to this New York Times article. And again, I could not find the actual article, but the rapid test for asymptomatic individuals may not be effective. I don't think that the jury is out on this, but certainly the study that came out of the University of Arizona is certainly something that is going to raise eyebrows. I know it raised my eyebrows. Okay, so let's talk about COVID-19 and viral transmission. There was a great review article, and I think that it's starting to become a pretty much the best understanding that SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19, is mainly spread in households and household-like settings. And what they did is they did a review of multiple other articles. It was published in Scientific Reports. And what they found was that a majority of the infections happen within households and other residential settings, kind of like a nursing home. And as we know, the virus usually spreads through close contact with infected individuals, especially those that happen for long times. So again, those that live with others, other household contacts include many forms of high intensity, close and long duration of interaction. And also they found something that's going to come up again in another study, is that spouses are more than twice as likely to be infected as other household members. So I think what we're seeing with coronavirus is that a majority of the infections do happen at home. That's one way that there's transmission. A second way that there's transmission are these super spreading events as well, kind of like what we saw on Sturgis, motorcycle rally, and multiple other super spreading events like the choir practice in Washington State, where you have one person transmitting to a large number of others. So those are the two main ways. And again, just want to be very clear that it's the congregate setting or it's the home setting that significantly increases the likelihood of transmission. And so if somebody is sick at home, or if somebody is in your home with COVID-19, it would behoove everybody, one, to keep that person sequestered or isolated, and two, make sure that everybody is masked. Okay, so the CDC then also sticking to this theme of being at home, and these are the next couple studies. The CDC specifically looked at what is the U.S., so the U.S. rate of household transmission of COVID-19. We've seen it in other countries. We've not seen what the rate is here in the U.S. So what the CDC did was they studied households in Nashville as well as Marshfield, Wisconsin. And what they found was that a secondary infection occurred at a rate of 53% of household contacts. Now, the next study we're going to go over was almost five times that amount. So 53% is high, but that was one study. But the next study is going to show that it's even higher. And the other thing that's important as well is something that we're starting to see more and more of, is that the rates of asymptomatic versus symptomatic are different. So for those people who are asymptomatic at home, there's less likelihood of transmission then those people who are symptomatic at home, they're more likely to transmit. So, of course, anybody who we suspect that may have COVID-19, again, needs to isolate, stay at home, use separate bedroom and bathroom if that's even possible. Isolation should begin before seeking testing and before test results become available. All household members, including the index patient, should start wearing a mask at home, particularly in shared spaces where appropriate distancing is not possible. Okay, so what about risk factors for COVID transmission at home? So this study was specifically looking at risk factors. So what are the risk factors for COVID transmission at home? So a retrospective study in Singapore that happened between January and April of 2020 looked at 1,000 PCR-confirmed index cases. And then what they did is they went to their close contacts, so 7,500 of them. So this is a fairly large study, as well as about 2,000 household contacts and another 2,000 work contacts. And what they found was that the secondary clinical attack rate, the odds ratio was 5.9. So it was about almost 600%. So it was huge. So the clinical attack rate at home is really, really quite large. And sharing a bedroom with somebody, so like we had said earlier, like a spouse, that increases it again. Being spoken to by an index case increases likelihood of transmission. So this, again, speaks to the importance of masking. And then non-household contact, like work contacts, there was a slight increase of about 30%. Social contacts, also a slight increase of about 30%. And so one of the things that was really interesting was that things that did not lead to infection included meals sharing. That was interesting. Indirect contact and then also sharing a bathroom were not independently associated with SARS-CoV-2. So what do I take from this is that that folks at home, again, if somebody is at home with COVID-19, that there is high risk of transmission to other people at home.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
In the 1980s, Portland, Oregon was a sleepy city that largely existed outside.